Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast. We are so fortunate and super excited to get to interview Dr. Jeff Rausch, who's a practicing dentist still in San Antonio, correct? And also now, basically, I guess, I don't know whether they call it part-time or full-time or whatever, but basically, you are a huge part of what Spear is doing and a lot of their education, which is way cool.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
So what I'd love to do is, I just kind of want to hear your story, right? I find that a lot of times the story brings out good questions and good opportunities for discussion. And how does someone, start their career, go through the hoops, and then be associated with something that, frankly, I think Payman and I would argue is the pinnacle of being associated with a guy like Frank Spear is... in our industry, it doesn't get much better than that.
I totally agree.
So why don't you kind of just tell us your story?
Well, interesting. I have a 13-year-old son, and we were just doing a parent-teacher conference, and they were looking at what he was going to do next year. And one of the things that he said is, I'm going to be in speech and debate. I don't have a choice. And the teacher looked at him, and I said, no, that's right. He doesn't have a choice. And that's really where I started learning how to speak and learning how to do research. And I was then a radio disc jockey to put myself through college.
No way.
And so I learned to be really comfortable with researching and speaking. And so that was my foundation that I came to dentistry with.
And why dentistry?
So because I didn't want to be a physician, and I had been on that track, and I got to my senior year, and I had shadowed people, and I decided that wasn't what I wanted to do. And I kept thinking, well, I could be a high school biology teacher, or I could work in a lab, and I hated all that. And I had a friend that said, hey, I'm going down to take the DAT this weekend. Do you want to go with me? And I said, sure. And it was like $20 at the time. And on the way down, he said, here, look at this book. And
so you literally just winged it.
Yes, basically. Totally. Totally. I had awesome. No idea what a dentist did.
Yeah.
Nothing. Got into dental school, luckily, which I wouldn't now, the way when y'all are going,
you have to be so
competitive.
You have to be intentional about it. Very, I think, is the big, it'd be hard to do that now.
You really, really have to love it to be able to study.
It was just a fluke.
Was it in Texas, University of Tennessee?
University of Texas, San Antonio, okay. Yeah. And I got in, and it happened to be a really good point in time for that school. So it was a very important school at the moment and of time that I was there. And unfortunately, a guy said when I got in, C equals DDS. So I just said, well, heck, I can make a C. This is easy. But I didn't have a clue. And I met a guy my senior year that I ended up partnering with down the road, Bill Robbins, and Bill gave me a vision of being better, and that got me into a residency in Connecticut. I did 2 years there, practiced as a general dentist for 12, and then went back and became a prosthodontist in 2000.
So how did we, so you said you met, talk a little bit more about meeting him and having that relationship, because that clearly did something to you that took you from wanting
absolutely
to just get C's to a residency, yep, and that sort of thing.
So it was... He was running, I always joke that he was running the gifted and talented program for the senior year, but I think they called it Honors Bay, which is the top 10 students in our class got to do things that were independent of what we would do. And part of it was they would do research projects. They would go to the library, research some area, and they would do presentations about it. Well, I already told you that I debated and I was used to speaking and I loved doing research. And so I heard that and said, can I do it? And it was the first time anyone had ever said that to him, and he had to go to everyone and ask, is it okay? And they agreed, and so I got to do that. And once I got to do that, then I got to do extra things. Like, I did my first veneer case 30 years ago, and I actually have veneer and porcelain onlay next to each other, and I have a photograph of it 30 years later.
Oh, my gosh.
I just saw the patient recently.
That's so cool.
And so I got to do that type of thing and see that there was another level of dentistry that I was never... I I honestly had no idea what a dentist did, even my senior year in dental school. I thought I would go back to Bryan, Texas, and I would kind of wander around and figure it out somehow. But I had never really been in a dental office at that point.
Right.
And now I finally saw a vision of I could be better than what I was really thinking.
Well, and what I love about that story, that it's kind of a minute little thing that you said, was, you know, how you talked about going up and asking and going for it. Because I think that's that small point there is what separates a lot of people from success and not success. And we get on to our peers a lot because we want to wait for it sometimes instead of taking the initiative to run for something and to look bigger.
So I totally agree. We were just visiting about this idea of legacy and legacy tour. Yeah. And the idea that there are my generation of dentists. I've been doing it 30 years now. My generation of dentists are really looking to give back. Now, the ones that are looking to give back are actually the best dentists in your community, I've found, because they're really good at it and they know they're good at it and they've invested a lot in it and they would really like to give that to the next
person
coming along.
For sure. They're looking, they get more satisfaction out of that at the point. I mean, they don't need to go and produce more and do more. I mean, I get that, yeah.
If you have to, though, express interest, rarely are they going to come up to you and say, hey, I would like to do this for you. But if you came to me and said, is there any way I could shadow you and just see what you do? Or could we go out to dinner and talk about it? Absolutely, I'd love it. In fact, I'll give you an example. So I also practice with Greg Kinzer and Frank Spear in Seattle. And I've been doing that for 2 years. 6 or 7 years ago, a young dentist in Kansas City came up to me after a lecture. And she said, I've got to learn more about what you're doing with this airway stuff. And we started communicating. I started giving her literature. We kept in touch. She moved from there to Albuquerque, stayed in touch. She then said, I think I want to go back to Pross like you did. So we stayed in touch. I helped her get into school. She got into, and she just graduated. Greg Kinzer said, I need someone to take over up here and really become a bigger part of the practice. And I thought of her. And so Stephanie Zeller
no
is now.
Way. The light bulb clicked when he got to that. I was like, no way. Stephanie.
I love Stephanie. I follow them. And now they have their own podcast, Dental Outliers.
Wow. Yeah.
So Stephanie Zeller is now basically taking my place in that practice because she was in a lecture and said, I've got to know more about this.
What a cool story.
And just stayed in touch and stayed.
Incredible.
And that story is not unusual. My story is not unusual and hers is not unusual. That if you will just put out the little bit of effort to say, I want to learn more. I essentially want to be you. I want to be a better version of you, but I want to be something like you. Then stuff like that can happen.
That engages a lot of stuff. And for those of you who don't know who Stephanie is, Stephanie Zeller, she's a prosthodontist and she has a great Instagram account that's worth following. The pictures and stuff she does is just, it's mind blowing. So check her out for sure. Okay, so you kind of have that engagement with that program and then you said you decided to go to a residency. Is that correct? Right out of gate?
I came right out of school. I went into a 2-year GPR and that really set a foundation for me. I went to Connecticut. And the residency was more like a PROS residency, so I had a very good background in it. We did all kinds of different PROS. At the time, Nobel implants they were Brandemark implants at the time, could only be restored by prosthodontists. And so that was a school that placed those implants, and so we needed prosthodontists to do it. And so they essentially trained us as if we were prosthodontists under the guidance of a prosthodontist. So when I came out of school, I actually worked for a surgeon that just put implants in. So I did straight out of residency. All I did was rehabs on implants.
Wow.
Holy
That's
cow.
Good. And you did that till you got to a point where you actually went back. And you
I bought a general dental practice, family practice, sort of changed it into almost like a PROS practice over time. Basically because I either hated or sucked at everything else but PROS. You know, you try to sedate a kid and they spit up the medicine on you. You know, that was the last time I ever did kids. I took out a third one time and it spun around in the socket and I couldn't get it out. That was the last third I ever took out. So I did endo and forgot to put the sealer in before we were using Thermofill at the time with this plunger deal, you know. So every time I sucked at something, I stopped doing it and I never really sucked at PROS. So, but yes, in 2000, I decided to go back and become a prosthodontist, but I couldn't afford to stop practicing. So I actually did it part-time. So I would go in the mornings to the residency, and in the afternoons I'd come out and work in my practice, and then in the evenings I'd go back and do all the lab work. And I did that for 4 years.
What did you think at that point? Because this is a question that I going back and forth.
What did
forth
I think?
About,
I thought I was crazy.
What did the PROS residency give you that you couldn't get from all that experience? Like, what is
it? No, that's a good question.
Or just continuing education, right?
Nothing.
A weekend course.
Nothing. Some of the best restorative dentists in the country are general dentists. So to say that you had to do that is not that you don't have to do that. There are two reasons that it was important to me. Three reasons. First is I'm incredibly competitive. And so for a prosthodontist and myself to be on a program and them say, well, that's nice, but this is the way we do it.
Yes.
That really bugged me.
Right.
Okay. And I didn't. You couldn't, it was hard to argue with it, you know, because they like got this instant credibility. So it really bugged me that way. So it was really competitive. The second part of it is that when I stand on a stage now and they introduce me as a prosthodontist, I'm given that credibility right away, which makes it easier for my message to get
You're
out.
You're on bigger podiums. You don't have to explain yourself. So like,
Damon and I talk a lot about that because, I mean, he's one of the most young and talented implantologists I know.
Thank you.
And we talk about that because it's hard for him to sometimes go in a room with oral surgeons and periodontists to speak because
correct. You're going to have, you're always going to have to prove yourself.
Yes.
And it's like, you have to prove that I belong here.
Yeah.
Then you have to prove
it's like a short basketball player. But I'm short and I used to play basketball so much harder. And when I'm doing this dentistry every day, I'm hustling and trying so hard. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm behind. So like, do I need to go back? So I constantly try.
The beauty though of I think as we move forward with information and be able to show stuff and stuff like Facebook and these groups. And, you know, what's nice is you can build a name and people can be familiar with your work a lot different way than they could have, right? I mean, if no one saw your work 20 years ago until it just like either got around to dentists or people heard you speak, it is nice that now you can give yourself more credibility earlier on, I think, because of that.
I agree. The difference is you always will fight it on the big stage.
Yes.
I don't think that
you're probably
just
right.
Pictures on Instagram and Facebook
it's
and
not
whatever
gonna
is not going to get
right.
your is not going to get you to that level of credibility. And unfortunately, the educational part of it plays a role in it. And it can happen. It just is harder.
Yes,
to
it
do
is
that.
Harder.
And that was one of the reasons. And the last year back to why did I do PROS? I thought I was going to retire out as being the head of a PROS program. That was my vision because I liked education. I thought I could see myself retiring and simply doing the teaching part of it. Now, I don't believe in coincidences. I think coincidences are just signals to you as to there's something going on. You need to pay attention. And I don't think it's a coincidence I went back and did that. And then was able to start practicing with Frank Spear and Greg Kinzer because I couldn't have done that had I stayed as a restorative dentist. And teaching at Spear, once again, it's easier that transition because almost all of our faculty are prosthodontists. And it just transitioning into that environment, I now can teach the airway part of it. I can teach. I'm now taking Frank's place in some of the other courses like Warren Dentition. I'm taking pieces of that lecture. And I would have had to have gained a higher level of credibility, which would have been significantly harder to make that transition. So
it was a good decision. I mean, eventually you're very happy with what you did because it allowed you to do a lot more than you could have.
So let's move into, because I knowing your story a little bit, move into, now you're a prosthodontist, you're doing that. When did the next kind of big challenge or hurdle come into your life that made you kind of move forward in your education and pushing, you know, yourself in even a higher level or more level, because it would have been very easy at that point to just say, okay, I'm going to be an educator at this level and I'm going to do PROS and everything will be happy.
So there, you know, actually I gave a lecture on the four important moments in time in my career and not too long ago. One of them was 1995. I saw John Coyce give a lecture and he was doing stuff I couldn't do. And so I sought him out, and Frank Spear and John Coyce were together, and then I followed just John after that. And And that was laid a foundation for my education up until the point when I went back to Pross. The second was when Bill Robbins, my teacher in dental school, started practicing with me in 1996. And we actually developed an entirely different way of approaching interdisciplinary treatment planning that ended up being a textbook that was published a couple of years ago. So those were two really important moments in time in my career. But the evolution, the real changes started happening when I got out of Pross and started looking at why things happen rather than how can I fix them. And that's where the airway component came into it and started dysfunctional airways as a triggering mechanism. That linked me up with Greg Kinzer. And when we practiced together, we've come up with protocols in order to let restorative dentists start figuring it out for themselves.
Where do, because we get this a lot, where do people even, because a lot, what happens is we come up with fake solutions of why things happen, or like, well, we're like, well, maybe that's what will explain something to the patient. We're like, really don't know.
Yeah.
How do you, yeah. I mean, I feel like toothbrush, like abrasion was always a big one. You were like, oh yeah, like all this recession's caused by, you know, brush your teeth too hard. And it's like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but that sounds good to a patient. But, and how do, what, there's people are curious, and I know that myself and other colleagues are, we see things that we don't know. Where do you start to figure that out, or where does them? I mean, how do you do that? I mean, where do you mean?
Well, once again, there are two things that I think are important. First is you can't get stuck in what you were taught in dental school. The hardest thing for me to get out of your mind is what you learned in dental school. For some reason, the first thing you learn becomes ingrained as the standard and everything else must rise to a higher level. And so part of me going back into Pross was, I mean, for example,
you wanted to
where?
Answer questions.
Well, it was also about little things like where and occlusion, occlusal philosophies. The beautiful thing about going back into Pross is I got to read the articles from where that information came. So we were all taught in dental school by a professor that got up in front of the class and said, here's why we do this and here's how we do it. And it got in our head, okay, these are the rules that we're going to play by.
Sure.
And then I actually went back and read the articles that told us what the rules were and realized those articles are horrible. I mean, it's some of the worst research you ever want to look at. So
we're basing these rules that define the environment we work in off bad
really
research.
Bad science.
Yeah.
So it then began... I began questioning everything. So if I said, I remember having this conversation all the time with patients. Your teeth are flat because at night you can generate 6 times the amount of power on your teeth than you can during the day. 6 times. So if you can put 200 pounds of force on your molars while you're awake, you can put 1,200 pounds of force at night. And everyone would just nod and go, yeah, okay, that's why my teeth are flat. Well, no, they're not. Well, when you really read the science, we don't generate anywhere near that kind of force at night, and we don't get superhuman strength at night. We generate about 20 to 40% of what we would ordinarily, with occasional peaks maybe approximating 100% of what you can do during the day. So you don't wear your teeth out at night that way. It doesn't happen. It's not the reason your teeth are flat.
Wow, yeah.
And yet that was
been
so ingrained. Exactly.
Yeah.
So even when we talk to, I've been asked questions over and over, why don't orthodontists do what you're asking them to do? Why don't they do this one? It's because what they were taught in school based on old literature is in their head as being right, and then everything else has to be better than that. So what I'm doing now in, it's a long answer to your question, what I'm doing now is saying to someone that disagrees with the point of view I have is, accept what I'm saying is fact. So what I'm saying is the status quo of what every dentist is taught. So we all believe what I'm saying. Now prove to me through your literature that I'm wrong. And then it puts the onus on them to show me better science than what I have available to me.
Which ultimately challenges people to think differently, which is a good thing. We have to have that, right?
So to people listening, younger dentists listening, what I would say is don't accept what you were taught in dental school as being fact. In fact, we've always said at least half is wrong. We just don't know the right, you know, which half is wrong. I'm going to suggest to you the number is way bigger than half that's wrong, and you need to start really investigating for yourself. With that in mind, it needs to be you. You need to actually look at the science. Too many times when you become dependent on
Google
magazines or, you know,
right.
or site like
Facebook groups,
yeah,
or
exactly,
somebody,
a Facebook
yeah.
group, you're getting, I mean, I read those things and
I'm sure
a tiny bit of it is really smart. I mean, some people are brilliant in their analysis, but some of it borders on malpractice. And so you've got to be really clear that not everyone with a Facebook site's giving you the truth, and you need to have an independent eye to trying to figure out what truth really is. So
now you brought up a very important and interesting fact about what is being taught in dental schools and everything. So now what do you think with dentists or dental students in going through that in dental school? Because if they don't listen, or if they don't follow what their prosthodontist or some of the dentists that their educators are teaching them, what is it like? What is it that I'm trying to find out? How come we cannot change that from dental school? How can we?
Why do you think education lags in dental schools? Like, why don't you think it's updating at the rate that the rest of the world is updating?
I think it's because continuing education is not a priority for faculty at dental schools.
It should be something they're required to do at the rate, basically.
But the dental schools are already having a financial burden, and to invest in their staff is difficult for them. And the unfortunate part of it is that the information doesn't get updated at a very rapid pace. To be fair, what their goal is not to train the best dentist. It's to train a dentist that doesn't hurt people.
Right.
Right? I mean, you've got to serve the public at a level that is, like I was learning, at a C level, right? We'd love to train great dentists, but honestly, their ultimate goal is to produce a dentist that can serve the community and take care of dental needs. Your goal in putting implants in is not their goal, and your goal of doing it at a high level is not their goal. Their goal is, if an implant is put in, can you restore it? Do you know physically how to make that happen without compromising the patient in any way? So
in a sense, there's not enough time for them to be able to teach everything above that level either.
Exactly.
So that's why you're going to go to residencies and things if you want to.
Correct. Or you're going to invest in education.
In education.
And the problem that we get into now is that it's a very difficult proposition for a new dentist to invest in education. And one of the reasons is you see the money rather than the value. It's like, I've got this much time off and this much money to invest, and it's hard to make to envision the value that you're going to get from that and the fact that it will pay off. And unfortunately, there isn't a shortcut right there.
No.
You have to put in the time.
Or we try to, what I worry that we're developing as a shortcut is that as awesome and good online learning can be, that we make that then the rule of thumb rather than something that gives us additional information, right? Because we talk about this all. I mean, the education that will go on right now during a breakout session for certain people and the conversations they have with people is just as educational or, you know, informational or motivating sometimes as the education itself. And so that's a thing I like to always reiterate, that online learning isn't a replacement for going and getting education as well.
Yeah, and with each subsequent generation, there'll be more and more online learning. I don't like it at all. I produce it for Spear. I make it all the time.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we're moving towards.
Right. So, but me personally, I want to be in the room with the person that's teaching.
Exactly.
I find more value from that interaction.
So true.
And it's not even that I have to talk to the person, but the physical presence of someone I think I'm focused on them. If I'm at home and I've got my iPad, it's harder for me to emotionally invest in that person. Now, that's me. My son is better at an iPad than I am in learning in that environment. But I still don't think it's the same. I still think in the end, once you have core concepts, you still have to be
present.
You have to be in that, you know.
I have what do you think about right now? There's a surge of so many CEs out there for dentists. So I get so many messages on a weekly basis or daily basis on sometimes, like, what do you recommend? What do you recommend? Like this. And then what do you say for these folks, young dentists? Like, what is it that they need to look for in that educator? And for them to be that, this is value. This is what I want to
learn. Or things are bought. That's the other problem,
right,
too.
Or some of these things from your experience, if you
want. Once again, we're having this conversation in this legacy discussion.
which was great, by the way. This is Seattle Study Club. I was so jealous because I saw all my mentors, Dr. Picos, John Coyce, everybody is there. I'm like, man, I really want to go to this club.
So it, we were having the discussion, this exact discussion. And the idea was that Greg Kinzer said, you know, if you want to be the digital dentist, you can invest and do these types of things. And I backed up and said, that's fine, which is your question. How do you pick where you want to go? And all. The key for me, for a young dentist, is you have to lay the foundation first, and then you can go whichever way you want. So you went into implants. I get it. But if all you knew was implants, you wouldn't know how to treatment plan the case.
Right.
So
or you learn the hard way.
Yeah. That's where I found out that, oh, I need to start COIS. Because after I did all these cases,
you
like,
need you need a foundation in treatment planning. So be it COIS or Spear's work. Obviously, I have a bias towards Spear.
Well, I'm taking facially generated treatment planning in 2 months. So,
you need a course like facially generated treatment planning. You need to own that material. You can't just take the course, but it has to become part of you. So I took COIS. I grew up with COIS. I went to my residency. I now do, you know, Spear stuff. I have this foundation. And from that foundation, you can go anywhere you want. But if you go there first, if you go off and say, I want to take a course in implants or I want to take a course in CEREC or whatever it is, and don't get the foundation, you will not be as successful. It's impossible.
And you keep looking back and see what I missed here. And you see so many older dentists that I see, and they look at their cases, they don't know what they missed because they never had that foundation.
No, you have
to keep patching things and putting things without actually knowing the foundation.
Well,
so
I think
it's
that's
so
one
of
the things Spear has done well in the layout of their workshops is by doing
Start with the foundation, and work your way from there, and you can go anywhere you want from there. And COIS does the same thing.
So many great advice today from you. Like, this is
amazing.
Okay,
we're not done yet. I have to ask a couple airway questions. So, let me give you a little bit of my story, and I kind of talk. So, I jumped into, I went to a course at Dentsply Surround the World in 2016 and heard Drew Nagarwal speak on sleep apnea. When I heard that course, and if you've heard T-Bone speak, when he speaks, he's very passionate and he connects with people. And I was connected with the person in the story he was telling, and more about himself was my dad. So I came back and I'm going to kind of jump into the deep end of the pool person. So I bought a take-home sleep test, you know, HSD. I was like, let's do this. Dad was the first person I tested, and he came back with, he had an AHI of 68. It was very eye-opening to everyone. My dad's my partner. I work with him every day. We were like, you know, nothing about, you know, very little at least at this point. We're like, let's put you in appliance and see what happens. And so we made an appliance, retested him, went down to a 6, and his heart rate dropped from 82 beats per minute to like 55 beats per minute. So overnight I was like, wow, my eyes were open to something that I was seeing glimpses and pieces of everywhere. I knew nothing about it and was like, I have to know more about it. So then I followed up with that and went and took Aaron, Dr. Elliott's course and their course for Sleep 101 and learned more about it there. And slowly my eyes have been open to everything that has to do with sleep. Or and what I learned is that the more I know or the more I learn, the more questions I have and the less I know and that sort of thing. So my question is when we start to expand in that and we realize the things we don't know, how do we ask the questions and where do we go to find information? Like, for instance, one thing I've noticed is you start to see the airway issues and something like what I see you're talking a lot about is children, you know, and not all children you're going to put in. How do you have that conversation with patients to, and where do you even send them or go? Because what I'm seeing is like, oh my gosh, you know, there are a lot of airway issues going on with these kids. Or people who don't necessarily fit something that a sleep appliance is going to fix, but I don't even know where to start. And what we're doing in the flip side of this is systemically is we just, you know, we're just throwing medications at it. Like, I mean, like everybody's got ADD and let's all give them all Adderall. And if I was born in 2000 versus 88, I'd be on 6 medications, right? You know, but
thanks,
and so
thanks to your dad passing along the airways.
I know. So yeah, him, I'm screwed with being 5'8" and a big neck. So okay. So let's talk. So talk a little bit about that and what your journey.
So let me take a few of the pieces of what you said. The first thing is I love that you heard something that was valuable to you and you jumped in. We were talking about what lessons to learn. What can you do? I think one of the lessons that dentists in general, but younger dentists in particular, need to learn is that you're never going to know everything, and you don't need to wait around until you know everything before you start doing some things, right? You started testing people, which led you to have a passion for making that person better. So you learned about that, which, so
I'm kind of trying to just, you know, once I get the hurdle, try to figure out how to jump over it.
Yeah. So don't be, you know, I had a friend that said, once I learn more about the screening devices, I'll start doing it more. And I said, no, start doing it more and you'll learn about it. It forces your hand to learn more about it. So do things. Don't sit around and take a course and go, yeah, I ought to do that. Do it. And then that'll force the next move, and then you'll actually grow. The next part is that you went after the low-hanging fruit, in my opinion, which is the fat old man with apnea.
Yeah.
And they're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And they come into our practices, and you'll see them, for example, at Spear on the screen. Those are all the rehabs that we do. They're full mouth rehabs because they got wear on their teeth and erosion on their teeth. And so you see them all the time. I just threw into the mix in back in about 2008 or 9 that they probably have apnea, and we started testing. The more I started looking at those patients, I said, that's easy, but where did they come from? And that's where we went backwards. And so now, instead of focusing on sleep, what we call it is airway, and airway prostatonics in particular, which is the impact that a dysfunctional airway has on the stomatonathic system. And there are two other groups of patients that are going to be in your practice. So fat old men, right, with apnea, but you're going to see young, what I call young fit females. Young fit females have insomnia. They can't go to sleep. They can't stay asleep. Now, they're not always female. They can be men, but men that have this tend to have a lot of muscle tone. So their airway doesn't collapse. They're just reactive. Women have progesterone as an advantage to keeping their airway open. So young women tend to keep their airway open all night long, but they're using a ton of energy to do that. And that energy is transferred to a chronic stress in the system, which creates inflammation and pain and all. Those are your TMD patients. So the last patients that walked in your door that you made a night guard for because they had pain, that's an airway patient. And then I went further back. I said those people came from somewhere. And we went back to kids and realized that my own son had a lot of these issues and that I had missed him for years. So our real focus is, can I find it and as early as possible and make it better? Because interestingly, some of the data is now saying if you can truly fix it young, you don't have to turn into the person down the road that is the AHI of 65. So my focus really is, can I prevent it? And if I can't prevent it, I missed it. Can I control it? Which is what you did with your dad. But I never stop at control anymore. So your dad, if he was a patient of mine, yes, he got controlled. How do I do away with the piece of plastic?
Yeah.
What do I do to make that go away? Can I?
Because even that's a Band-Aid to a degree.
Yeah. Can I do ortho? Can I do orthognathic? Can I do ENT surgery? Can I do a piece of everything?
Wow. Yeah. That's a totally way of thinking about it.
So that's where we're headed is I want to get it young. If I miss it, I still need to know all the little appliance tricks. We've created a thing called the Seattle Protocol, which is I don't believe everyone needs a sleep type of appliance. You've made night guards for patients and they go, I can't sleep without this. It's because they sleep better. With that increase in vertical dimension, that somehow makes them sleep better. So that's a sleep appliance for them.
Yeah, sure.
And so we have a protocol.
Issue we didn't know we were managing.
Exactly.
You know, by doing that, yeah.
So we have a protocol we walk through. And then in the end, we go, how do we do away with your night guard? How do we make that go away so that you don't need that? Because the minute you take the night guard out, the minute your dad takes it out, he has an airway problem all day long. And he's sympathetically active all day long and he's damaging himself all day long. But if you could make him into the night guard or at least a close simulation of the night guard, he's going to be healthier all day long.
Wow. That makes total sense. I found too that I struggle because I see an airway issue. But currently, if it can't be resolved, I see a patient, they come in and that something's going on, right? Something's causing damage. Something's going on. Well, if they come back and they've got apnea, well, then I'm like, okay, well, I know how to fix that, right? I can give them appliance and then I can test that again and see if that's gotten better. The problem I'm seeing now is, okay, I'm testing people. They might come back normal. But yeah. there's still clearly a problem.
All right. Yeah. So two things. One is you jump from apnea to appliance, and I don't think you need to go there.
Right.
In fact, the bulk of my patients, I can get better by just teaching them to breathe better through their nose at night. I mean,
really?
Almost ever.
Wow.
So I rarely make appliances anymore.
Cool. Okay.
Okay. So that's the first part. The second is exactly the battle that we have with physicians, not battle, but disconnect we have with physicians is that they're looking for the person with disease. We're looking to prevent the disease from ever happening. So you're finding the signs and symptoms in the mouth well before the medical complications going to come along, which is beautiful. Unfortunately, it makes us not be able to work really well with physicians because they don't get paid to keep people healthy.
Yeah.
They get paid to deal with people after they're sick. And so it provides us an opportunity because that's a patient they're not going to want to be involved in or can be involved with. And so we get to do anything we want and call it dental. So a lot of our dental treatments are exactly, we're the only people, dentists, orthodontists in particular, orthodontic surgeons, we're the only ones that can actually modify anatomy. The ENT doesn't modify anatomy.
Sure,
they make bad anatomy smaller, yeah. So it fits. The sleep physician doesn't do that. They give medication. We're the only one that fixes the true anatomic problem. And so we have a huge role to play in being able to find it early, fix it early, or if we miss it, fix it later on and actually make it more ideal and let the body do what it's supposed to do. By the way, that to me is the most exciting thing about being young like
that. Well, and so that literally was, that would kind of transition my next question was, because I feel like that's, you know, 10 years ago, or even way longer than that ago, but the last 10 years, like implants for something, you know, is something that everybody's wanting to place and do. You know, my gut feeling is that over the next 10 years that the airway stuff is going to become so much more apparent and so much more, and we're going to have an opportunity to really impact that. So I think that's pretty cool.
I do. I agree. I think that incorporating, in fact, I've already seen it. I was telling you about the four moments in time that were important. 2013, I made a presentation. In 2010, I made another presentation. Those two moments, those two large, important groups, both now, whenever cases are put up on the screen and questions come from the audience, they always focus about airway. There's always an airway question. So airway has now become part of what everyone is starting to see. They still have trouble figuring out what do I do, but they're seeing it. And so the next 10 years is what do I do? And dentistry is going to take over that role from medicine.
What's next for you? Because I feel like, you know, it's been fun talking to you because a lot of people at this stage in your career would, you know,
not
hang it up.
What I mean
by that is accomplishments, right? Because you're clearly still pushing, right? And so that's my, not hanging up in that regard, but just like the majority of your age group is coasting. I mean, that's the reality, I think.
Yeah,
and so,
well.
And you're not. So what is it that, what's next for you? And how are, I mean, because you obviously are just as energized, it seems like.
Yeah, I got a 13-year-old son, so I still got a ways to go.
You know, yeah.
We were talking about Legacy Tour. That was the name of the, but I actually, 3 years ago, I wrote down on a piece of paper the word legacy on the top of the piece of paper. And it wasn't really about my legacy in dentistry or what people will remember me. It's what I could leave dentistry. And so, to me, if I can leave something to dentistry, it would actually be the connection that's going to, in my opinion, happen over the next few years between medicine and dentistry, that we will start to be seen as a healthcare profession rather than just mechanics of teeth. And I am going to push as hard as I can to make the dentist the leader of that team so that we can actually be seen as doctors, right? So that you don't have to be ashamed anymore. You're not a real doctor. Yeah, you will be. And I'm going to be leading the team that actually is going to start making people
that's
healthier.
That's an incredible goal.
So that's a good goal. Especially having my brother and sister both MDs, I can go and tell them I'm the real doctor.
I love it. Well, Doc, thank you so much.
That
I mean,
was
this
fun.
Has been
Thanks,
this has been a pleasure. So
it.
I really
Great.
Do.
Thank
so
you
I look
so
forward
much.
To, I look
yes.
forward to
Thanks.
Chatting more in the future and,
yeah.
and
hopefully
kind of
we'll
watching
see
your stuff. And of course, I cannot wait. We're super excited as a team to partner with Spear and help out anyone because they're frankly. It really is one of the, if not the most premier education I think that we can get out there, and it's from a global scale. I mean, it's not just one area. That's what's so nice about it is it does take a look at the big picture. So, thanks so much, Doc. I appreciate it.
Thank you
thanks.
Very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.